Hello, everybody. Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. Glad to have you with us on this Friday before what I hope for most people is a long Memorial Day holiday. Let the summer officially, well, not officially, but as far as holidays go, get underway after Memorial Day. Jim Galloway continues on vacation. He is out for the next week. We look forward to getting him back. If you follow his Twitter, you'll notice that he may be in England. He's up in North Country, but he is tweeting about the news back here. And so you can continue to follow him even as he continues his vacation. So let's get started with today's show. Jackie Cushman is here, Republican, long time daughter of Newt Gingrich. We say that every now and then. We don't know, always want to identify you as the daughter of Newt Gingrich. I mean, you're a fully realized human being in your own right.
Thank you, Bill. I appreciate that.
You can read Jackie's column. I go to it at JackieCushman.com. You can also go to it on Town Hall, blog site. You had something, you had an interesting column that you were posted the other day about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. What was the basic premise? Tell it. So
the basic premise, and it really wasn't about her, it was really quite frankly about the lack of, I think it was a failure to communicate from the Republican side.
Right.
So, you know, her brother actually put her up for the, I think it's Justice Democrats who were a candidate recruiting site. They picked her, they helped her run. She obviously won, but she ran against an incumbent who, quite frankly, was rarely home and didn't even attend the debate with her, but sent somebody else,
which was a terrible visual.
Exactly. Just a note for anyone that's actually in office, you should probably show up, you know, for a debate and actually show up for your district. So she won, but the interesting thing is when you look at the, you know, she's a socialist, democratic socialist, and if you look at their platform, they talk about how they're for this, that, and the other, but they can't actually implement that without government control. So then you come down to the socialism versus kind of capitalism debate, and if you look at what's happened in the last 70 years in terms of where we are in America, our views have shifted dramatically about how we think about socialism and how we think about capitalism, and it's really on the socialism side, and really more people now identify it with equality and justice versus a way to control the economy, which is the traditional definition. So my point was, we're really not communicating that in the right way. Republicans aren't, because they've kind of changed the definition of socialism along the way, which is interesting.
Yeah, and I do recommend that column because it's something we've started to talk about and we will continue to, the way in which socialism is being used as a weapon, the way it's being weaponized in the 2020 campaign cycle. So go read Jackie's column at, as I said, JackieCushman.com or Town Hall. Next to her, if you're watching us on Facebook Live, which of course you can do if you go to GPB News on Facebook, is Professor Audrey Haynes, University of Georgia political science professor and the head of the Applied Science Political Science Program, where she works with students, trains them how to be professionals in the world of politics, right?
That is absolutely right. And we just sent a whole bunch of them off in the summer to get a lot of good experience working for people like John Lewis and Jody Heiss. So I'm looking forward to hearing what their experiences
are
like.
Well, thanks for making the trip from Athens. We're glad to have you here, Audrey.
Glad to be here.
Right across the way, Representative Scott Hocum, Democratic representative. How many terms now, Scott?
This is my fifth.
Is it really? Wow. Do you have opposition in the 2020 race at this point?
I'm sure I will. I've had opposition every single cycle, and I expect
you're not,
to have it.
You're right. They like to try to take you on.
That's right.
Thanks for being here. And next to you, Amy Steigerwald, who teaches political science at Georgia State University. And that's just one of the many hats you wear. You're a constitutional, legal scholar. You've written several books. One of the most interesting, probably for purposes of the discussions that we have, is about the trajectory of women in American politics. You've tracked that. So thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's start. We expected that when we were putting the show together this morning, that the top story would be, thank goodness, farmers in Georgia and other areas of the country hit hard by disasters would be finally getting relief money, because yesterday the United States Senate did in fact end the standoff and vote for relief funds. Now, we'll get into a little bit more detail in a moment or two about what the Senate finally arrived at, the compromises that had to be made to get the $19.1 billion package approved. So the Senate passed it. The House had already gone into their holiday recess. And so this morning, all what they really needed was somebody to gavel the House into order, even without members being there, and ask unanimous consent to pass this bill finally and get help to people in Georgia, people in California, people in Texas, people around the country, in addition to the money that was needed in Puerto Rico. Okay? And then Texas Representative Republican Chip Roy stood up as they were trying to get the consent passed and said this.
If I do not object, Congress will have passed into law a bill that spends $19 billion of taxpayer money without members of Congress being present here in our nation's capital to vote on it. Secondly, it's a bill that includes nothing to address the clear national emergency and humanitarian crisis we face at our southern border. There's no reason this disaster supplemental should not have included the quite modest $4.4 billion that Director of OMB Vogt sent to Capitol Hill to ensure DHS and HHS do not run out of money, which they're slated to do, while managing the over 100,000 illegal aliens crossing our border, being apprehended, and unaccompanied alien minor children being unable to be housed appropriately. And finally, this is a $19 billion bill that is not paid for.
That's Representative Chip Roy, a Republican from Texas, objecting to the unanimous consent, which means that the Democrats, who in control of the House, of course, can keep having someone get up in the week ahead and gavel the session to order and ask for unanimous consent. And if there's no Chip Roy or someone who's part of the Freedom Caucus who would agree with the effort to hold back on this, they can still pass it by unanimous consent. But it also means it is quite possible that it will be June 3rd before Congress reconvenes. That's more than a week away, and farmers are still struggling. Have I got that about right? Yeah, Audrey?
Yes, yes. We were talking about that earlier, and, you know, yesterday was a moment where, you know, Senator Perdue especially had a moment of real accomplishment. And, you know, it was, I would say he and Senator Shelby did a lot, used a lot of their own political capital. Shelby made some sacrifices to get this passed and to get the green light from President Trump. And here you have a freshman member, Freedom Caucus, who stepped in and put a halt to it.
By the way, he was a staff member on the Hill. He was Ted Cruz's chief of staff, I think, before he finally won election. You know, it's what were the? I'm not clear on. Here's what we do know happened, and somebody jump in. We do know that one of the holdups had been the president's reluctance to support more aid for Puerto Rico. He had one version of how much money Puerto Rico had already gotten. Democrats had a different version. He wanted money withheld from them. But then he added a pretty good chunk of money for border security. And Jackie, apparently in a phone call with the Puerto Rico issue went away, but apparently in a phone call with David Perdue yesterday, the president was persuaded by Perdue this was getting serious and that he should drop his demand for border funding and just go ahead and accept the bill.
Well, absolutely. And this is a real, this is, to me, this is a freshman congressman who wants to make a name for himself. The reasons he listed don't even make sense because, yes, the first one, yes, that's how you pass unanimous consent and it's done. So this is not, it's kind of like a silly even, I mean, this is kind of silly. And then he wants to include money for certain things and then he talks about how they shouldn't do this without funding it anyway. So, like, his arguments don't even make sense because they contradict each other. So what I really think you have here is that you have a freshman congressman who, you know, was elected with help from a, you know, very fiscally conservative. We can't spend any money until we actually raise it or know where it comes comes from. And so he's taken a hard line. And, you know, we've had other people that have done that and made quite a national name for themselves. So this is a way to garner press, you know, press attention. And it's really too bad because, to your point, this is really needed for Georgia and for other areas. And, you know, Senator Perdue worked very hard with the president and actually got him to say he would, you know, support it and sign it, which was really good. And so we'll see how it comes out. But hopefully, my guess is there are several people that have talked to the representative after he did that. And maybe they'll try again. We'll see. But it's really, too bad.
Yeah, we really don't know. Scott, here's the question. Is he a lone wolf? Is he an outlier? Or we are told in reporting by Tamar Hallerman, who put together a piece on the compromise yesterday, that when Perdue called the president to say to him, please, Mr. President, let's move forward, there were members of the Freedom Caucus with the president arguing for him to stand firm. So he could be an outlier, or we could see an effort by some of the Freedom Caucus next week if they try for another unanimous consent vote. Maybe they'll have another member of the Freedom Caucus object to that.
I wouldn't be surprised, and it's one of those to-be-determined outcomes that we'll have to see. And I did find it very interesting that Governor Kemp's office sent out a statement on it praising the president and the Senate and then asking the House to act, but conveniently omitted the fact that it was a Republican member of the House that led to this current situation.
I noticed that. I brought that statement in with me. There is no question, Amy Steigerwalt, that Governor Kemp is as frustrated as the farmers themselves, well, maybe not as frustrated as they are, but frustrated, that David Perdue, Johnny Isaacson, everybody's frustrated. The Democrats are frustrated. But to Scott's point, here's the second sentence or paragraph of the Kemp statement. Thanks to President Trump and the Georgia delegation, true enough, Hurricane Michael victims will finally receive the resources and relief they so desperately need to rebuild, replant, and prosper. Yesterday, the U.S. Senate finally put thousands of hardworking Americans ahead of partisan politics. It's time for the House to cut their vacation short, return to Washington next week, and do the same. So to Scott's point, this is a Republican rebelling, not the Nancy Pelosi Democratic House.
No, and I think that's actually where a lot of the concern is coming from, that there really are sort of two different things that are going on here, right? We've got the fact that there is a lot of partisan polarization, which is stopping a number of things, right? And we particularly see that in which, right, the earlier versions of this bill were not brought up in the Senate, right? This has actually been passed multiple times in the House. It wasn't brought up in the Senate. We finally get the compromise in the Senate. It passes 85-8, so overwhelmingly. They've got the president on board who's calling, and then you still have another group, though, who doesn't want this, and they're really fighting with their own party members and bringing this forward, and I think it's of concern. Because the other part of this is, I mean, a lot of the funds were going to be going to the home state of Representative Roy, right? So he's not only blocking this as kind of a great statement, but he's also blocking it from people partially, you know, possibly even in his own district, which is of concern, and which I think is going to be interesting to watch, denying Trump a really easy victory.
Yes. Right?
This should have been simple. This should have been simple. It should have been signed by the end of the day. Should have been taken care of. And so that's going to be an interesting thing to play out, right? I mean, in the Oval Office, Representative Meadows and Representative Jordan lost, right? And Senator Perdue won,
right? And they punched back.
And then they punched back, and now they're really denying the president a really easy legislative win.
You know, Jackie, it's interesting, isn't it? It's the rhetoric around this just in the last 24 hours has been fascinating. Yesterday, after the Senate finally moved, David Perdue's office, understandably jubilant that they'd made this work, put out a statement by email with this subject line: President Trump breaks through logjam on disaster relief. Well, yes, he did, because he decided not to fight it anymore.
Well, he decided to compromise, which to Tammy is a great point. That would have been great for everyone to see some actual compromise and something happen.
Yeah.
Again, what we don't know, which I would love to know, is, you know, is this a lone wolf? Is this someone acting on his own to get the national publicity, which he is obviously getting, not only, you know, nationally, but here in Georgia, to get the name recognition and to get to speak on the floor, or is this a coordinated effort? Hopefully it will be able to be passed soon. I know that we in Georgia definitely need it, and I really commend Senator Perdue for all of his work in getting President Trump to actually move in terms of what he would accept.
Well, you know, that, okay, so Scott, we know that President Trump he reads the tea leaves, he watches Fox News. I think if I were a Georgia farmer, I might be a little nervous about how the president could react to Chip Roy standing up and objecting. Could this, in fact, have any impact on whether he wants to stick to this compromise that he's made? We'll see about that.
I think he's in a little bit of a tough spot because he needs to placate the farmers, and he has the issue of the tariffs as well, and the bailout for farmers, which he's proposing because his easy trade war isn't so easy. And then he also has to placate his base, which he is continually riled up on anti-immigrant rhetoric. And so those two things are not easy to square. And I think he probably is very disappointed that now they have to potentially go back to square one in this discussion, although more like than not, even if this is held all next week, it should go through on June 3rd.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that the House is going to pass this, right? I mean, this is going to be approved. Audrey, there are some, though, who down in South Georgia, for whom the game is already up. The planting season, in many cases, has kind of come and gone, and some farmers have already had to take out second mortgages to get through a season where they don't expect to have crop. So, obviously, they want this passed, but is it too late?
Well, I would like to say I hope it is not. Farmers are very resilient. They go through these cycles, and most of them that are still in it know how to plan for these types of situations. And unfortunately, there are likely to be more. And some of the legislation in this bill itself is focused on building infrastructure and preventative measures and having things like flood insurance and community support that will go to help them as well, not just relief in particular, but building to the future when the expectation is we're going to see more types of turmoil and disaster based on hurricanes, tornadoes, and flooding, and so on.
All right. Well, we're going to watch how this plays out. And in the meantime, one other note, actually. When David Perdue's office sent out the note which congratulated the president for breaking the logjam, it was interesting to note the difference between him and his office and Isaacson and his office. The Isaacson office sent out a release that emphasized how disappointing it was and that the senator was, Isaacson was, that it took this long, which is interesting. So we'll watch how it unfolds, and we'll see if they attempt to break the get past a unanimous consent motion next week, or whether they have to wait till June 3rd. But, you know, Jackie, I don't think anybody looks great in the way this thing played out.
Well, I'm not sure, quite frankly, Bill, that anyone looks great anywhere in D.C. right now about anything.
Okay.
I don't think I would limit it. Yeah, I don't think I would limit it just to this particular issue, but yeah.
Fair point. Hey, while we're talking agriculture, we should talk, and Jackie, let me start with you, if I can, on this, about the fact that the president and his ag secretary, mm-hmm. Sonny Perdue, former governor of Georgia, have announced that they are going to come up with a $16 billion bailout, essentially, for farmers that will help relieve some of the pressure caused by the pain that farmers are feeling because of the tariffs that have been imposed, particularly in terms of the tariff war with China. Good move.
Oh, I think he has to do it. I think it's a smart move. I think you've seen in the last week some change in terms of how they're going to fund it. Part of that is, I think, Trump wanting to know what his end goal is and not really understanding some of the mechanisms and the best way to get that done. But I think, again, a different Perdue, but the Secretary Perdue is trying to educate him on that and think of the way to best implement that. And that's kind of where they are is using the agricultural department to to help with those subsidies for the farmers directly.
Audrey?
Well, it'll be interesting because a lot of I've been listening to the rhetoric coming out of the Trump administration in relation to this. And, you know, words like patriotic farmers, and they are being attacked by China, when really this is a response to Trump's own sort of retaliatory tariffs. And in the long run, the ones who are suffering are the farmers. So as Jackie said, he really doesn't have a choice. That's an important part of, you know, his voting base. And it's also an important part of America. I mean, these are the people who feed us. And when we start to feel a pinch in the grocery store, people will start to pay attention. So the direct payments will be interesting. I went online and was looking through the Department of Agriculture's website about that yesterday. And one of the things I will say about Secretary Perdue is, you know, he is a intelligent and individual and a cagey politician, too. I think he is doing his best to work not only for the people in the state of Georgia, but really for the agriculture industry in the state. And I would note one of the things that I saw was a report on the impact of climate change on that website. You don't hear about that as much in relation to sort of the disaster and some of the other issues. He's paying attention to the global situation with agriculture. He knows that if we are not trading, that there are people in South America who are totally willing to trade with China. They are right there and they are looking forward to it. So I don't know what will happen. I'm pretty concerned with this.
The issue here is, Scott, that the president talks about tariffs in a way that I have to acknowledge confuses me. He said yesterday in announcing this that the $16 billion would essentially, he didn't say it in these words exactly, but essentially said, we'll pay for this through the tariffs that we've imposed on other countries. Well, it's not the other countries that are paying these tariffs. These tariffs are going to come out of the pockets of Americans who are paying higher costs for goods and services. And so there's this odds. The president wants us to believe that, in fact, thank goodness we're making all this money from foreigners who are now, you know, giving us the ability to pay the $16 billion to the farmers.
The president is not an astute economist, nor does he well understand trade policy. Tariffs, as you said, are taxes. And so this whole thing is neither fiscally conservative nor fiscally responsible, because what he is doing is he is increasing taxes on Americans because of all the products that are coming into the United States from China and from others that he's imposed tariffs on. And now he's going to spend $16 billion on top of earlier billions that he spent to then help cover the losses that the farmers are having, which that's going to then be funded by taxpayer money as well. And the ultimate end game, I understand where they're trying to go, but I'm not terribly optimistic that they're going to get there anytime soon. And probably China is going to do everything they can to just wait him out and see if he's a one-term president.
Yeah, the stock market for the last couple of days seems to think that it's possible this is going to linger and linger, because the market, haven't seen the market in the last couple hours, but it's been way down.
No, that's definitely very true. And the other thing, you know, sort of as we've talked about, right, with the planting seasons and things like that, part of the problem is that, right, farmers need to make long-term determinations about what they're going to do, but they also need to try to figure out, right, where their markets are. And we're forgetting sort of about the third parties, right, because the farmers grow the product, but then they're not the ones who are transporting it across state lines or transporting it to other countries or the ones importing it, right? That's people in other places. And part of what we're seeing which may not be able to be rectified is that, for example, right, China buys a ridiculous number of soybeans. Well, right now, they're not buying soybeans at all from the United States, and they're buying them from other places. And the question that's going to arise is whether or not they will go back mm-hmm. to the U.S., or if they will say, you know what, we managed to find another place to buy these from, and so we don't need this anymore.
I don't want to spend too much time on tariffs, but let's be clear about one thing. There are few Democrats or Republicans or Democrats who don't think it's time for the United States to find a way to have fairer trade agreements with China. The president may be getting criticized, Jackie, for some of his approaches to this sort of thing, his inconsistencies, whatever, but he's got almost, but most people out there are saying, who know what's going on, saying, we've had to deal with China for a long time. Cannot undercut him about that issue.
No, his intent is exactly right. I mean, China has for a long time, their market is closed to a lot of our goods. That they constantly and consistently steal our intellectual property. I mean, that's just like they just, like whenever they want to and do whatever they want with it. So in terms of a relationship, if you look at the entirety of the relationship, it is not a, to your point, it's not a fair relationship. So the question is, how do you make it more fair? I mean, Trump's determined that if he puts enough pressure on China, that China will have to fold and at least give in to some things. And as always with Trump, we won't know whether he's right or wrong until we actually sit back and watch it right. unfold.
I got to get to a break. But as I go to break, I just want to add one comment about this, if I may. And I'll give any one of you one moment to respond. The one thing I really did like seeing in this $16 billion package was, you know, it is going directly to farmers, as Audrey pointed out, much of it. But a portion of it, and I don't have the figures in front of me, is going to be used to purchase food for food banks around the United States. And there's no question right now that food banks need every bit of the help that they can get. So the notion that the USDA is going to, in fact, institute a plan that helps stock food banks, hard to argue about that, isn't it? Everybody agrees. Isn't that nice?
Yeah. All right. Well, actually, I'm going to plug on that one of the things that's been most disconcerting is that there's been a couple of new reports coming out about how many, as speaking to Audrey and I, how many college students are having to recently skip meals and how many colleges and universities are having to put in place their own food banks and things like that. I mean, it's a real issue, right? Food insecurity is a real issue, yeah. And we need to be doing more about it no matter what.
All right. You know what? Maybe we should do a show on that at some point down the line. Food insecurity in general. All right, let's do this. Let's get to our first break in the show today. When we come back, there's really no way to do a show about politics in Georgia these days without talking a little bit, at least, about the latest on HB 481, the abortion bill. We'll do that and more after this break.
You know, selling a car can be a hassle, but donating it is a whole different story. Let us take it off your hands or off your driveway and turn it into public radio and maybe even a tax deduction. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl, the host of Marketplace, and here is how to donate.
Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or donate securely online at gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
About 50,000 people a year die of opioid overdoses. Why then might a new drug to treat addiction be blocked from the market until 2024?
We are deemed safe and effective by FDA, but we are unable to make the product available to patients during this crisis.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered this afternoon from 4 to 7 here on GPB and gpbnews.org.
During the break, very senior producer, Tom Faust, pointed out to me that we've just posted, coincidentally, a story that our digital news editor, Ellen Eldridge, posted about the very issue we just talked about, food insecurity for students. So go to gpbnews.org, and right now it's up there as the main story on that page. Okay, so... Amy, let me start with you on this, because you did a terrific podcast with Robert Jimison, and which you talked about the legal, your interpretations of what HB 481 says in terms of whether women who have abortions can be prosecuted, whether the doctors can be prosecuted, or the like. The AJC did a piece this morning in which they tried to survey dozens of district attorneys around the state. We know that four in the metro area have already said they have no intention to use this law to prosecute doctors, I think women either. Mm-hmm. But in the survey that the AJC did, while many people did not respond, there seemed to be genuine questions. I was going to say confusion, but it's not confusion. It's just there are questions that many of those DAs asked about just what this law does do. And or either that or said they were going to take this on a situation by situation basis. So while many people in the governor's office, particularly, are trying to say, don't be silly, while Renee Unterman tried to say, don't be silly, you can't be prosecuted. There does seem to be enough question out there in the legal community that we might be a little concerned about this.
Well, I think one of the things that can be difficult is that legislative intent doesn't overrule what the actual legislative language is. And so if the legislation does, for example, X, Y, or Z, even if that's not, in fact, the legislator's intent, that is still what the law says. And once the law is on the books and it's enacted, prosecutors, right, district attorneys, et cetera, have a lot of discretion about how they charge things, right, what they're going to prosecute, and also how they're going to interpret. And so a lot of these things, right, we sort of find out after, for example, a case being brought against someone and then trying to determine what to go from there. And as you said on the podcast, I would argue the issue is not about criminal abortion. The criminal abortion statute, which for those of you who want to get really wonky is 16-5-140, was not changed at all in this law and only is applicable to providers. It doesn't speak to women. However, what the law also did was change the definition of person, a natural person, to include any human being with a detectable heartbeat. And that was done at the very beginning of the code, right? Yeah. In section one. In fact, section 1-2-1. And the implication of that is that that means that that definition is now used throughout the entirety of the rest of the code.
It will be
once it goes into,
as of January 1st, if
it goes into effect. Yes, but
okay.
So if it goes into effect, that is now that, and so that means now that is the definition of person when we talk about, right, as the law even explicitly says, the census, when it's talking about child support, when it's talking about taxes, and also when we talk about other crimes such as potentially homicide,
yeah,
and things like that.
Scott, there's never been an uproar. I cannot recall, even Roy Barnes passing the new flag back in 2001, an issue which has so caused such an uproar across not just the state, but now we're hearing it in national news reporting. This is a very, very big deal.
It is. It's momentous, and the stakes are high. And I think this confusion by prosecutors, and I will use the word confusion because I think that there is uncertainty in terms of how this should apply, and that is very dangerous in terms of public safety and in the pursuit of justice. There needs to be a clear playing field. And you mentioned Renee Unterman saying that this wouldn't be used in a criminal context, but she's also said the opposite. And she is the Senate sponsor of the bill, and the House sponsor of the bill. His words and her words are not consistent. And that's a huge problem when you have the two people who are the primary sponsors and advocates of this legislation. They can't even agree on what it means.
Jackie, I've talked to a number of Republicans who essentially, they basically support doing something to restrict abortions. Mm-hmm. Whether or not they support 6 weeks or not is another question. But they are concerned, from the several people I've talked to, about the way in which the governor has tweaked the noses of film and television industry people, calling them C-list celebrities, saying we're not going to let our morals be dictated by those people out on the West Coast. And I'm hearing Republicans who say quietly, he's got to find a different way to talk to those people. How do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, the last few times I've heard him, the governor, talk about this, I've heard him talk about that the majority of Georgians believe in life and the right to life. So I have heard him, and I don't listen to everything he says. I don't have that much time. But the last few times I have heard him talk about it, though, that's the way I've heard him couch it. So I think maybe he's listening to some of those people push back. I too have concerns about the way it was written. I think, quite frankly, we've gone through this before on this show, but you know, I had a miscarriage before I had my two children, so I've been through the loss of that as well as having two children. And I personally believe my beliefs in terms of when life begins is probably different than other people. But I think the challenge is from a legal standpoint when you start saying we're going to count them in the Georgia census at 6 weeks, I think it becomes very confusing. And how do you even actually implement that? Like, how do you even know whether or not people are showing? I think it just becomes just wildly impossible to actually carry out the law, to be quite frank. So I think that, again, as Amy mentioned, I think this is a choice where, you know, the intent may have been to do one thing, but when you actually look at the way the bill was written and how it was laid down in terms of the law, there is a lot of confusion. I think the other thing that was also known is that everyone knows, I mean, the reality is this could be challenged. I mean, that's just a fact, right? So that's going to be happen. It's going to be challenged in the court system. And the question is, does it actually get implemented in January, or is this a way to move up? I mean, we have other states. I mean, God bless Alabama. The reason they're next to us is to make us look better sometimes, right? So they've even passed a more restrictive law where it's not even just earlier on, but it also will not allow in cases of incest or rape. So they're even much more restrictive than we are. So I do think it's a national issue, partly because we've seen some opposite laws in Virginia and in New York pass that say, you know, if a baby is delivered and it's, you know, you can actually go ahead and infanticide. It's kind of nuts. So I do think the national conversation is good. I think some of the things in the details just don't make sense. And that's the challenge.
So thank you, Audrey. Just a partial list. Amazon just canceled a scouting trip for a picture they were going to shoot here called The Power. They were thinking about coming in here next year. Kristen Wiig, who is not a C-list celebrity, confirmed that her upcoming comedy for Lionsgate, Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar, is no longer going to shoot here. We know that Ron Howard has said he's got a project here. He's going to go ahead and do it, but he says he won't continue to work here if this law goes into effect and it becomes an actual law, barring the court challenge. Chris Bagwell, who is the head of Screen Gems in Atlanta, EUE Screen Gems, has lost a Netflix shoot at his place. So, you know, this thing is snowballing. It's easy to say, oh, this is just going to be something we got to get past and we'll move on. But this is snowballing.
Well, you know, one of the things that we'll likely see is that this response is sort of divided in two. You have a group of individuals who find this to be so abhorrent that they are pulling out of the state of Georgia. You know, we may go from third largest state in relation to TV and film. We may fall in that because of this. But then you also have a group of very important directors who are part of that stay and fight element, where we don't want to harm the people who work here in this industry that we've built up over the years. We're going to, you know, contribute to the fight against the legislation. But I would also suggest that Governor Kemp has to sort of thread the needle with this one if he starts to see an impact, and he has to be careful about, you know, not punching in a way and calling people C-listers when those are people that do contribute to the state.
Yeah, and that's, Scott, that's one of the points I wanted to ask you all about, is he is, after all, at the state convention, he's throwing red meat out to his base. But he is, after all, the governor of the state, who presumably has the best interests of all of us at heart and wants the state to be a better place. How does taking a pugnacious tone with the industry help?
Well, he's done this throughout. Let's not forget that. He had this stance throughout the session, and he wasn't alone. There were other very senior Republican leaders who said that they didn't care what Hollywood thought. They laid that down. They made it very clear that they did not care, and they moved forward anyway. So they can't be throwing up their hands now and saying, oh my goodness, why is this happening? They knew exactly what they were doing when they pushed for this vote, and they can't be surprised now. And then them throwing out insults and names and engaging in very juvenile behavior isn't helping the cause. And it is interesting to see the two camps, but my own sense is it's probably going to get worse. I think Georgia is not setting a very welcoming tone for business right now.
And I would say in terms of interest groups, so Faith and Freedom, Free and Right, they are really pushing hard on these issues. This is an area where they feel like they're winning. They didn't do, maybe they've put aside, gay marriage and that element of the Religious Freedom Act. They're concentrating on this one. And the element, the framing of it is there is no cost to this state or any that is equal to saving those lives.
All right, I got to get you another break. I always feel compelled every time we have this conversation to say that we talk about it in a political frame, and it needs to be in a political frame to some extent, but Faith and Freedom Coalition, Ralph Reed founded that organization, of course. Jackie, I don't have any question that there are many, this isn't for them all politics. There are moral questions that they believe
absolutely
need to be addressed.
You know, the real challenge you have is you have, I mean, to your point, that group, they firmly believe the conception, quite frankly, the life begins at conception, which if you believe, you'd actually have no abortion at all, right? And that this is, from their perspective, that they're giving in by allowing that first 6 weeks. And it is a very hard topic. It is, and I think part of it is we have to figure out how do we beef up areas where we can actually work together in terms of either absence, sex education, prevention, a lot of prevention. I mean, work with groups to do that, as well as, you know, work on the adoption side to make sure that if there are pregnancies that they don't want the children, that they can go for to families that actually want them. So I think there's a lot that can be done that we could both agree on the kind of the outside. And maybe if we worked to that, that would help us out. But it's a really hard issue because there are really huge differences of beliefs.
All right, let's do this. Let's take our final break of the show and come back and talk about some more issues on Political Rewind.
On the next Fresh Air.
I'm crying because I love you. Bom, 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 bom. And we were in the middle of a whole different song, and I said, we need to do that.
Rapper and singer Lizzo will tell us about creating the title song on her breakthrough album, and we'll talk about much more. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB and online at gpbnews.org.
My name is Lauren Lynn, and I'm the Associate Director of Marketing for Georgia Farm Bureau. Georgia Farm Bureau is the voice of Georgia farmers, and we work earnestly to support the state's leading industry, agriculture. We underwrite with GPB. What I like about the programming is that it reaches a diverse audience, and it enables individuals or organizations the opportunity to share their messaging across the state.
To find out more about becoming a corporate sponsor, email sponsorship@gpb.org.
Going with that.
Scott Holcomb, I'm going to throw one out. We didn't talk in advance about this. Are we going to see any more Democrats get into the United States Senate race? Like, Scott Holcomb? I mean, is Teresa Tomlinson now going to have the field to herself? When? It seems odd to me that we haven't seen anybody else since Stacey Abrams over a month ago now said, I'm not running. What's going on there?
There will definitely be other candidates. I've heard several names that are likely going to get in soon.
Who?
Feel free to make an announcement here.
Yeah.
Yes.
not my name, but some that you'd be familiar with.
Michelle Nunn. Michelle Nunn.
No.
Jason Carter.
That's one I heard.
No. I've heard John Ossoff. I've heard reporter. Jason Carter.
No.
There's a mayor who I think is looking at it, a Metro Atlanta mayor. There's a candidate from the 2018 statewide cycle who I think has taken a hard look at it.
Scott. Thanks, Scott.
Helpful, right?
You're not. I mean, your name has been thrown around. I've asked you on the show before, but we haven't seen you since Stacey said no. You're not getting in?
It's not something that I'm thinking about, no. And
okay.
There are a few reasons for it. One is just, without sounding trite, I really do think that D.C. is broken, and I'm effective here in Georgia, and I'd rather be where I'm effective.
Yeah, Jackie Cushman, you nod, because you've seen broken Washington over a period of decades and know what it's like.
And it seems to be more broken than it used to be.
Yeah.
At least when my father was speaker and Clinton was president, they would argue, but they did eventually.
They could
make,
talk.
They made decisions and moved forward.
They shook hands.
Stood together. So.
Let me take just a couple minutes, because I want to get your thoughts on all this. You know, we talk about disunity, we talk about chaos, but I said at the very top of the show in introducing the subjects we were going to deal with that there is an issue that Democrats and Republicans in Jackson County have come together on. You've got the chair of both the Democratic and the Republican Party there trying to help citizens of Houston go ahead and call for the resignations of the mayor, Teresa Kennerly, and one of her city councilmen for racially divisive, insensitive, pick your word remarks. Scott, the people up there seem to want to get the mayor out for having refused, saying that she would not hire an African-American city manager because the people of Houston were not ready for a black person in that job.
She needs to go. It's insane. This is 2019, not 1963. I mean, it's absolutely crazy that this is happening, and she needs to go. She should have already been gone. It's unacceptable.
You know what's interesting about this, Audrey, is that Houston is this growing community.
Fast growing.
It's very, people seem to like it there. There seems to be a real progressive element in that community, and I assume it's surrounded by pretty conservative folks, right?
Yes, and that may be the reason that you're seeing this unified set of county party organizations coming together and saying, what the heck are you saying or doing? And especially with Jim Cleveland, who didn't even try to hide the fact that he can't watch African-American people on television without getting really, really upset.
Well, I think he said that he what he can't tolerate is intermarriage, right?
Yes, but that quote, when it was sort of taken without that feedback, was just damning.
Right.
It just was so damning.
Right.
And then,
I'm really glad to see them come together. I think that totally makes sense. I mean, good for both sides. Hopefully they can get, to your point, they can get through this rapidly and move on, because it sounds like a great community. And I'm glad to see at least somewhere the parties are working together.
It's true, Amy. I mean, you know,
it
good
is
for
true.
Them.
And I mean, I think the other thing is, this is a, you know, we sometimes would like there to be some positive signs of things, right? That also they're coming together, not only in a bipartisan way, but to say, like, look, this is not okay stuff to say. I mean, as Scott was saying, this didn't happen 30 years ago. It didn't happen 40 years ago. This wasn't a secret tape that was unearthed. It was last week. And last week, you had people who were still suggesting that they can't look at people of two different races having a loving relationship. Like, that sounds kind of crazy.
All right. Well, we're going to watch how that unfolds. What they're being, the citizens want them to resign. If they don't, they start a recall? Is that the way the next step would this would work, Scott, probably?
I'm not an expert in our recall elections, but I don't think they're easy to do. I think the best thing is just for these folks to just step down, because then there's also not the costs of a recall election and everything else.
Well, and maybe just as a note on that, I mean, I think that's where some of the issue comes in, that it is difficult when people are in office to remove them, right? We don't have a lot of mechanisms for that, and we just had elections, so they're not going to be removed anytime soon, and so there is a big of a push of, you know, please do the right thing. But if they don't, then there has to be a lot of money spent not only by the citizens, but by the city in order to sort of address the issue.
All right. Scott Holcomb, I want to start with you again, because you're a legislator. You all in the Georgia legislature have spent a lot of time the last couple of sessions trying to figure out what to do to help rural Georgia. I mean, it's been a big, big part of your agenda. You've taken some steps that are meaningful. A lot still has not been done. Rural health care remains an issue that needs to be resolved, right? But I say that as a context for the latest census report study, which shows that even as you're doing everything you can, or trying to do what you can to help rural Georgia, people are abandoning rural Georgia in droves. And here's what the Census Bureau just reported. In the past year alone, more than a third of Georgia's small towns lost population. New census estimates show that Camilla fell below 5,000 residents, Sparks fell below 2,000, Fort Gaines dropped below 1,000. They lost 7% of the population in one of the communities. And they point out that even Georgia's tiniest town, Edge Hill, lost one of its 24 residents. And at the same time, Atlanta is growing its population. And of course, doing something about rural Georgia's economy could possibly stem that flight. But is it just a losing battle?
I'll be really candid. I have a lot of skepticism on whether or not it can be changed by policy moves. And the reason is, if you look at this and you really take a step back globally, you're seeing mass migrations to the cities all over the place. It's just where we're going. And cities are the dynamic aspects of today's economy. And it's hard to see how that's going to change in the short term. And the future of work and the future of jobs are increasingly tied to cities. So I don't know exactly how we turn that around. It's very, very troubling. And the two biggest ailments that rural Georgia has that the legislature has tried to work on, healthcare access and access to broadband, which is key for economic, mm-hmm. educational, and healthcare purposes, they all require some government intervention. Mm-hmm. But there hasn't been a lot of political will to do that in terms of the really hard calls that I think that we need to make. Like, by way of example, Medicaid expansion would have really helped, but that hasn't been something we've been able to get through here. So I am not short-term bullish on what's going to happen for rural Georgia.
Jackie, am I right that in the long run, Republicans, of course, control the legislature and the government here. Am I right that it's to Republicans' disadvantage if rural Georgia keeps evaporating? Because if people move to the cities, you'll have Democrats will have more concentrated power.
Well, I think quite frankly, it's a disadvantage to Georgia to have everything centered in Atlanta. I'll be honest with you. I mean, I work on quite a few nonprofits, one of which is, the Trust for Public Land. And we're constantly making sure that we're doing work in places other than Atlanta because we want to represent the entire state. So I think it's really important for us, especially those of us that sit in Metro Atlanta, to remember that there is a state bigger than we are. Having said that, interestingly enough, while we have, as a nation, all been moving into urban areas, that's a fact, right? When you ask people where they want to live, it's not reflective of where they want to live. They actually want to move away from the cities, but the jobs and opportunities are in the cities. So, you know, the question becomes at what point. Because now there are some people that just work from home, right? They get their computer and they're not even in an office. At one point, if you do have the infrastructure, can you replicate that in other communities that are outside of Atlanta? So I do think that you're right, that in the short term, it's probably not going to happen. But I am optimistic that in the long term, we will figure out a way to create this networked community that has access to information and technology so that people can live in a different life. Because quite frankly, people don't like living in suburbs and driving an hour and a half each way to work.
I've got about a minute. What do you want to weigh in, each of you, Amy?
Well, I think we've got a couple of things. I mean, I think number one is this recognition that, you know, in these communities where we are, the smaller communities where we have seen an uptick, it's in part because jobs have gone there. So, for example, Amazon built a new fulfillment center in Jackson County, and so people have been able to move there. So the problem is that there has to be something to move for,
right.
And there also has to be the infrastructure to support people. So there needs to be hospitals.
Broadband.
There needs
and
to be
hospitals.
Broadband. There needs to be clinics. And so in many ways, it's whether or not we're going to put that in and how we're going to separate all these things out.
Audrey, you get a few seconds to add to this.
Well, I would just say we have a lot of cities in the state of Georgia that are great. Savannah, Columbus, Valdosta. Maybe if we invested a little bit more in those cities, we would see an expansion of into the rural areas near them. We've got lots of places to grow.
So by my count, we have talked about two subjects that are worthy of special shows, food insecurity and this one. Mm-hmm. What do we do mm-hmm. about the imbalance between urban and rural Georgia? And you know what? We're going to put that on our agenda to try to do that
in the months ahead.
Memorial Day coming up on Monday. I'd hope to go around and ask you all about relatives, members of your family who had served. I will tell you just very quickly that my father was on a refrigerated cargo ship in World War II in the South Pacific, away from the woman he loved, who he was going to marry when he came back for a couple of years. She waited for him and San Francisco, and we all have stories about the people we love who served in the military in one way or another. We're thinking about them and all of the members of the military who are serving us today on this Memorial Day weekend. Have a good one. We won't be back till Tuesday at 2:00, but we'll see you then.